I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to continue a conversation as old as the creation of America and as fresh as today's news. We're going to talk about immigration and the American dream. Specifically, we're going to talk about who owns the American dream. My guests are Terry Downs, Executive Director of the Immigrant Welcome Center, Angela Adams, an Indianapolis immigration law attorney, and Ali Nourani, Executive Director of the National Immigration Forum. Please join this timely conversation. Call 866-476-3881, email nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking about immigration today as the Immigrant Welcome Center prepares for its September 7th fundraiser, which is titled Who Owns the American Dream? If you want to join this conversation, I know from past programs people do like talking about this. You can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, and you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are a couple of veterans of the program, Terry Downs, who is Executive Director of the Immigrant Welcome Center, and Angela Adams, an Indianapolis immigration law attorney. And joining us by Skype is a newbie for the program, Ali Nourani, Executive Director of the National Immigration Forum. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you, John. It's great to be back. Thanks, John.
It's good to have you here. So first, Terry, we'll get the logistics out of the way.
And then
I want to talk about the larger subject, because it's almost impossible to find a single news hook for this conversation because there are so many of them occurring now. But talk to me about the September 7th fundraiser, Who Owns the American Dream?
It's a very timely issue right now, and we are thrilled to death to have our third annual fundraiser next Thursday, September 7th, beginning at 5 p.m. at the Biltwell Event Center, which is just south of the Indianapolis Zoo, very close to downtown Indianapolis. We are very fortunate to be joined by two national immigration experts, Ali Nourani, who's on the show today, as well as Cheryl Winterick, who is a TED Fellow and is going to be giving a TED Talk on immigration. And then we'll switch over into a local business panel, including Doug Dawes from Cummins, Dr. Mercy Obamy from Franciscan Health, Nasser Pater, the Chancellor of IUPUI, Dr. Artie Shaw from Eli Lilly and Company, Patrick Tam, the CEO of the Indiana Restaurant and Lodging Association, and Michael Corbin will be our Master of Ceremonies and panel moderator. We're also thrilled to be offering food samples from seven local immigrant-owned restaurants, including Bosphorus Cafe, Fresh Indian Grill in Carmel, the Heidelberg House will be providing desserts, Giallo's African Caribbean cuisine, La Mestiza, a new Mexican restaurant in the International Marketplace, Santorini Greek Kitchen, and Mimi's Meatballs will all be providing food for our guests that evening.
So, Ali, what are you going to talk with them about when you come here on September 7th?
Well, I mean, first of all, I think that the work at the Welcoming Center and so many organizations in Indiana and Indianapolis have been doing is just remarkable. But I think, you know, the larger context of this question of whose dream is it is something that I think all of us are really grappling with. And I think the leadership of the faith, the law enforcement, the business community, the immigrant community in Indianapolis is something that, you know, frankly, a lot of folks can be drawing from.
So I think we got to deal with, and Terry and Angela have been on the program before. We've talked about immigration. It's always been a charged subject that the people have strong feelings on just about every side of the question here. I think it's probably also fair to say, though, that the question has become even more charged in recent months with the election of President Trump. Could we talk a bit about how President Trump's ascension to the White House has transformed the conversation about immigration in this country? Angela, I haven't talked with you yet, so I'm going to give you first crack at that one.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting to see that immediately folks became very interested and wanted to become more involved on the issue. And with the Immigrant Welcome Center and other nonprofits, and the National Immigration Forum is another good example of that, people just started coming out of the woodwork and said, what can I do? How can I be more involved? And so the good thing, I think the positive that's come out of this is that we're all talking about the issue much more than we were before. People that didn't know about, the details are very interested in the details. It's becoming meaningful because they know someone who's really impacted by the issue. Or they can't find workers to fill positions. We hear all the time from manufacturers and landscapers and agriculture and hotels and restaurants that they've got all these positions to fill and they can't fill them. And so this is a really timely issue and one that needs to bubble up to the top and get to the level of Congress so that Congress can do something. So if anything good comes out of this, I hope, sincerely hope, that it's a greater awareness, a better understanding and depth on the issue so that we get to a better place for the United States on immigration reform.
Ali, how has the discussion been transformed in recent months?
Well, I think, I go back to some of the early data that came out last summer of 2016, when, researchers really started to try to understand what was happening within the electorate. And they found that the Trump supporter was worried about, whether or not their children would do better than them. And in then-candidate Trump, now President Trump, they found a person who they think will make their children's lives better, which, when you think about it, is very similar to what an immigrant mother or father wants for their child. Mm-hmm. But what has happened as a result within the debate is that, people have been led to believe that immigrants and immigration are a threat to them and their families. But there's an interesting kind of paradox there is that, and, we see this a lot in the Midwest and the Southeast and even the Mountain West, very conservative parts of the country, is that, conservative Americans who are really struggling with this question in a very honest way, they love the Jose or the Muhammad they know, the person who they, they work with, their child goes to school with, the person that they go to church with. But the Jose or the Muhammad they don't know, whether it's one town, one city, one state over, that's the person they have that they're very, very worried about. And they feel like something will be taken. So I think we have to understand how the debate has changed. But we also have to understand that, folks are developing these relationships at the local level. And so how do we kind of take that relationship with the Jose or the Muhammad that a person knows and, extrapolate it, if you will, to the broader immigrant community across the country and, slowly but surely kind of take some of the fire out of this debate right now.
How much of this, I was struck with something you said at the start here, Ali, which is that, that the primary focus with the Trump voters was that they were afraid, that they're worried that their children would not have better lives than they would.
Mm-hmm.
The premise there seems to be that somehow this is a zero-sum game, mm-hmm. that somebody else's success denies me or mine the opportunity to succeed as well. Is there any way to combat that mindset?
That's a really, really good question. I think that there is a way to combat that mindset if we are, number one, working really hard to understand what somebody's concerns are, what their fears are. And number two, and this is, I think, the most important, is to start a conversation based on the cultural and the values-based concerns that are underneath immigrants and immigration and the challenge of this debate. I think for years, those of us who've been advocating for immigration reform, we've tried to make a case based on you know, politics or policy, you know, demographics are changing, or, you know, business needs X number of visas. That doesn't really address kind of the core cultural questions or concerns somebody has. So, like you said, something is being taken from me, whether it's my, you know, what I believe or you know, my job. So I think we have to reshape the way that we're having this conversation with people, not talk about this in a political lens, not even talk about this in a policy lens, but really, you know, kind of paint a picture of an optimistic future where our economy is not a pie that's limited. It is a pie that grows. And, you know, the more that the American worker and their family is living and working alongside or in complementary fashion with the immigrant and their family, the more that we all are going to benefit.
I've often wondered whether, you know, even the idea of using the pie image is somewhat limiting when it's more like a soup. It's fluid.
And
it flows in a lot of different directions.
On a moose, right?
We are talking about immigration on No Limits today. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Caroline has done and give us a call or send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Caroline writes, in the debates against immigration, I often hear people saying things like, I lock my door not to keep people out, but to protect the people that I love inside. They use that argument as to why immigration should be limited. What do your guests have to say in response to someone who says that? Terry, I'm going to give you first crack.
I like to remind everyone that the United States is a nation of immigrants. And just as Ali had said so eloquently a few moments ago, it takes all of us to build a country and to build neighborhoods and to build a community. And I believe that diversity really helps to do that and really builds a very special community in which we all learn from one another and we grow together. I personally don't believe that it is, like you say, a zero-sum game, that by limiting the number of foreign-born people into the United States will somehow strengthen the United States. I see it just the opposite. I see it as an opportunity for us to get to know people from other countries personally, to develop our economy, and to be able to learn from one another.
Ali, though, that is one of the central fears here. I mean, that was, you know, at the heart of President Trump's bad hombres remark and all of that. How do we get people to reason in the face of that fear?
Yeah, I think that you know, a lot of people see diversity as a threat and to who they are. So when, you know, when the president says that we're going to reclaim our culture, we're going to reclaim our towns and cities, and when he uses this language in the context of the immigration debate, he is, you know, it's we're well beyond the kind of the dog whistle phase here. We are now in a place where I think the president is trying to really, you know, unfortunately divide Americans on this question. On the other hand, you have members of Congress, you have conservative faith leaders, law enforcement leaders, business leaders, really, you know, quite influential people in communities who are saying, you know what, people are coming from around the world to Indianapolis, and Indianapolis as a whole is winning as a result. And I think that more and more we have to, you know, frankly, look beyond our elected officials to the institutions in our communities, whether it's an organization like the Welcoming Center, our churches, you know, PTAs, our schools. And I've just come to believe that our community-based institutions, whether they're public or private or nonprofit, are going to be the place where, you know, we recreate the civic fabric that, you know, quite frankly, makes America great.
Angela, I'm going to give you the last word in response to Caroline's question.
Thanks. So from a legal perspective, just because I'm a lawyer, so I think like that sometimes, you know, I think Ali's point about the economy is very important in talking about talent, talking about the people that I see every day that I cannot fix their status, that companies can't get the workforce or companies can't get the talent that they need to stay in the United States. I think when we talk about doors or walls, we also need to talk about what those doors are going to look like and how we can unlock that door for the people that we need to build and grow the economy and to keep our workforce competitive and to keep the talent and diversity, the strength of diversity in our communities.
We are talking about immigration today on No Limits. My guests are Terry Downs, Executive Director of the Immigrant Welcome Center, Angela Adams, an Indianapolis immigration law attorney, and joining us by Skype, Ali Noorani, Executive Director of the National Immigration Forum. I am John Krall. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, Director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. In anticipation of the Immigrant Welcome Center's September 7th fundraiser entitled Who Owns the American Dream, we're talking about immigration today on No Limits. My guests are Terry Downs, Executive Director of the Immigrant Welcome Center, Angela Adams, an Indianapolis immigration law attorney, and joining us by Skype, Ali Noorani, Executive Director of the National Immigration Forum. So, Angela, you started to make, before we went to the break, and I could tell you were running up against the clock a little bit there, what is, in effect, the economic argument?
Mm-hmm.
And to put this, it's a subject we've talked about often on this program. The fact that most economists in the world say that by the year 2030, which is now just a little more than a dozen years away, the world's going to be looking at a worldwide labor shortage, and the competition for labor is going to become really, really intense. Many countries, Germany and other others, have opened their doors in anticipation of this, trying to get people to relocate. We seem to be going the other direction. Could we talk about perhaps what some of the consequences for that might be for shutting the doors as the demand's going on? Since I cut you off with the time clock, I'm going to give Angela, but then I want to hear Ali's thoughts too.
Sure. So, one really great example is we see students. This isn't just about undocumented immigrants. The conversation about immigration is about legal immigration as well, and opening those doors for folks that have talent, and that so that our major corporations can be competitive in a global economy. We see all the time that graduates of our U.S. institutions, IU and Purdue and other Indiana colleges and universities, who we've educated, they've been here on student visas, and then they graduate and they're working here, but then they can't get H-1B visas because there aren't enough H-1B visas available. So we're essentially pushing them out. Once we've educated them and they're here, we're pushing them away from the United States. So we're losing a lot of talent that way. And it's very concerning to see big corporations like Cummins not be able to get the visas that they need to fill those positions of high-skilled immigrants, high-skilled workers. So this, it's a spectrum, low-skilled all the way to high-skilled.
Ali.
Sure. So, earlier this summer, Senators Cotton and Perdue and President Trump, they announced their support for legislation called the RAISE Act. And the RAISE Act, over time, if it was to be signed into law, would slash legal immigration by 50%. And the problem here is that the nation's economy is about to go off of a ledge in terms of a workforce that is contributing to our growth. The American Action Forum, which is run by Doug Holtz Eakin, who is one of the leading conservative thinkers in Washington, D.C., they found that by 2020, which is the end of President Trump's first term, the United States economy will face a private sector worker shortage of 7.5 million. So just when we are going to be needing to fill 7.5 million jobs in the private sector, the administration and certain parts of the Republican Party would like to take us to a place where we're actually slashing our foreign-born workforce, which at the end of the day does nothing to serve the economy in Indiana, much less across the country, because, you know, I would argue that, you know, our nation's economy needs a skilled engineer as much as it needs a skilled farm worker. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we need bipartisan solutions that get us to that place.
Terry, do you want to weigh in on this?
No, thanks.
Okay. All right. Well, we have a comment, implied question from a listener named James via Facebook. And if you want to join the conversation via Facebook, you can find us at No Limits WFYI. You also can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Call us at 866-476-3881 or send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. James writes, as someone who is currently involved in trying to get my fiance here, most people don't seem to understand how difficult and expensive the whole process is. For an adjustment of status, which is to get a green card after we're married, by itself will cost $1,200. That doesn't take into account any of the other costs or previous government fees that we paid for. Terry, I'll give you first crack at that one.
Or attorney's fees.
Either one, yeah, attorney's fees to get to that $1,200.
Angela, do you want to speak to that?
Well, I think, you know, James is correct. It is. I mean, people don't understand that there are a lot of hoops to jump through. There are applications. There are fees involved. USCIS is largely run by the fees that they collect, and less taxpayer money and more fees from those applications. And so, yeah, I think it is really important to recognize that there are, you know, same thing goes for someone like refugees, for example. We have this conversation all the time. Refugees come to the United States and they've already been through 2 years of vetting before they get here, and they come in lawful status to be resettled. So there's a lot that's already in place to weed out the bad apples, to weed out the criminals or the, you know, threats to national security, which need to remain in place. We just need to educate folks that those things are there, and they're there for a reason, and it's a good thing. But folks like James and people that want to do it the right way and want to get their fiancé here, or someone, a loved one or an employee here, should have ways to do that. And the current law many times forecloses the opportunity to get those visas.
Ali, this is a simple question, and it's one I have asked before, but I think it is at the heart of this. I mean, what really drives all of the tension around this issue is fear. I understand the survey results and looking at what the Trump voters were, that they're worried about the future, really, and the future for their children, future also for themselves, and they seem to fear that, attach that to immigration when it could just as easily be, you know, your next-door neighbor is, in theory, mm-hmm. competing for the same jobs that you are, the kid you grew up with, all of those folks. What is it about immigration that kicks this fear into overdrive?
Well, I think it's I can't remember who said it earlier, but it's part of our DNA as an as a country, where as a nation of immigrants, we've always had these moments in our history where this economic, this cultural, this security fear that we feel is directed at immigrants. And these days, when, you know, somebody clicks on the news and they see, you know, whether it's people fleeing Syria or people fleeing Central America, there's this assumption that, you know, the next day that person is going to show up, you know, at their, living next door to them. So, you know, I think the way that people are taking in information, the way that information is being presented to individuals is spiking that fear. And I think that at the end of the day, our political leadership, and both Democrats and Republicans are to blame for this, is, you know, I think there has been a real lack of leadership of people who want to bring the country together across cultural, racial, ethnic, and economic lines. And I think in Indiana, you have people like Greg Zeller, the former attorney general, who are outliers, who, you know, Republicans who really worked to bring people together across these lines. And I just think that we need more political leadership and civic leadership that are helping people struggle through this conversation in a really honest way.
Terry, where do you think the fear comes from?
I think the fear comes just from the unknown and feeling like you're different than me, and therefore I hold you in some suspicion and doubt because we probably don't think alike. We probably don't speak the same language. We probably don't eat the same foods. And my way is likely better than your way. And I think for most people who have friends who are from other countries or who have the privilege of working with immigrants and refugees as I do, you realize that there are just so many more commonalities than there are differences in work ethic, in dreams for what your children will become, for what your family will be able to accomplish in the United States. And it still gives me such great hope to work with so many immigrants and refugees who say it is such an honor to be part of the United States and to be here, and I want to contribute and I want to be an American.
That's something, though, I want to follow up on a little bit, because we talk about the commonalities, and one of the things in the reporting I have done over the years, this issue, talking to you know, the refugee and the overlaying sort of, you know, combination somehow of terrorism with Islam and all of that is a separate issue. But the thing that, you know, a lot of what triggers this is fear about immigration from Latin America. You know, we can say, yes, they do speak a different language, perhaps, than we do. But one of the things that has impressed me in the reporting when I've talked to undocumented immigrants is that, given half a chance, I would say probably 80% of these folks, A, they're conservative, B, they most likely find a home in the Republican Party. And yet that seems to be where much of the opposition toward them is lodged. And that's not the only kind of conundrum we have in this debate or paradox. Ali, how do we account for that?
Well, I think that the paradox here, it's cultural, it's values based, it's all these questions where they mix up into a really, really, you know, it's sometimes a very toxic mix that people can gravitate towards. So last year, I worked on a book project where I interviewed, you know, 60 faith, law enforcement, business leaders across the country, and actually spent a good chunk of time in the Midwest. And Doris Meisner, who ran Immigration and Naturalization Services for President Clinton, had a great line where she said to me, to paraphrase, "Americans cherish immigration in hindsight, but, you know, not so much in the present." So therefore, you know, for us as an organization, we're always trying to figure out, okay, who are the folks that somebody will trust? And let's be honest, myself as a Washington, D.C. based advocate, I'm part of the problem, right? But somebody's pastor, their police chief, the business owner they know, that is the person that somebody will look up to and say, okay, you know what? I may, you know, may not be totally bought into the economic case for immigration because, you know, I have some worries about my own job. But when the police chief says, we need to make sure that people who are here are welcome, and they trust local law enforcement, when the pastor says, you know, based on our faith, we should be welcoming the stranger, it starts to open up somebody's heart and mind so you can have a constructive conversation. So, you know, for us as an organization, we're always trying to expand our network of relationships and partners in communities so that those conversations are localized and that ultimately, you know, a policymaker can kind of look to their constituents and say, okay, there's space for me here to move forward in a constructive way.
We are talking about immigration today on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Janaya has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Did I get anywhere close to pronouncing your name right?
That's perfect. Jhenaea is great.
Well, no, I want to get it right, and I apologize if I mispronounced it.
That's all right. Thank you so much for having me on. Long-time listener, first-time caller. Again, okay. My name is Jhenaea, and I just felt so compelled to call in today because Angela Adams was my husband's immigration attorney as we were working to get my husband legalized in the country and get his citizenship. And he did not qualify for DACA. He fell through the cracks on the system, just like so many others who are still struggling. He had a degree. He came here when he was 16, and he got his degree in mechanical and constructional engineering and a minor in mathematics. And to piggyback off what you said, given half the chance, they fight for their education. My husband, he fought really hard to work and become an engineer. And thank God that we met Angela, and she advocated for us and she pushed for us. And immigrants and people of color are looked at with a magnifying glass. So we can't afford to make mistakes. We have to be the best that we can be so that people see that we are contributing members of society. And my husband, as an immigrant, he always worked to volunteer, to work really hard to get his education so that people see, like, we don't fall under the same stereotypes that kind of plague the whole community of immigrants as a whole. We do great things. And there are so many students that are still struggling to get their education and to kind of fight past this blockade that we have.
Thank you very much for the call and for sharing your story with us. Angela, since you were referenced, I'm going to give you first crack.
Hi, Jhenaea. So good to hear from you.
Hi.
I'll tell you, you know, I'll echo everything she said and probably more so, and just say that her husband is, she pretty much downplayed it. He's amazing, and he is super talented, and he's giving back to his community. He's on boards. He's on committees. He's giving his time and effort. And I just think they're an amazing, amazing example of what the success stories that we see in our immigrant communities, but also an example of that. I think it was the Supreme Court that said in a Supreme Court decision that the undocumented immigrant of today could be the documented immigrant of tomorrow. So today we need to make sure that we're nurturing, educating, supporting the undocumented population, and especially people like your husband, Jhenaea, because those are the people that we want to be successful and to stay and be contributing members of Indiana, of the economy.
How common is that story, Terry?
We hear about success stories all the time through the Immigrant Welcome
Center. But also
Center
the challenge that went into that. I mean, we've heard two stories of how difficult it has been. James and Jhenaea were talking about how difficult it was just to get here, how much sacrifice they had to make.
That's exactly right. And we as native-born Americans don't fully appreciate how people struggle to get to the United States, how families have come from many, many different circumstances. Of course, our refugees come fleeing persecution, but we have many other economic refugees coming to the United States seeking a better life for their families.
We have an email from a listener named Marion, and if you want to join the conversation via email, you can do so. It's by sending it to us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Marion's really isn't a question as much as it is a comment. I agree totally with opening our doors to others. However, I have deep concerns about exploitation of immigrants for jobs Americans won't do, yet support our rich lifestyle and corporate interests, such as in slaughterhouses and CAFOs. Angela, I'm going to give you real quickly here. Obviously, there is a fear that we want to make sure we mm-hmm. do not exploit people while we bring them in.
I think that's true, and I appreciate that comment. You know, back to the gap in the labor force, we got to make sure that we're educating native-born Hoosiers as well at the same time, and also encouraging folks to take jobs that they maybe wouldn't otherwise consider taking.
We are talking about immigration today on No Limits. My guests are Terry Downs, who's with the Immigrant Welcome Center, immigration attorney Angela Adams, and Ali Nourani, executive director of the National Immigration Forum. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Thank you. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about immigration as the Immigrant Welcome Center prepares for a September 7th fundraiser entitled Who Owns the American Dream? My guests are Terry Downs, who is executive director of the Immigrant Welcome Center, Angela Adams, an Indianapolis immigration law attorney, and joining us by Skype is Ali Nourani, who is executive director of the National Immigration Forum. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Michael has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi. I want to answer your question. What I perceive is the answer to your question about fear. very quick. I'm the son of an Italian father and a black mother. And my grandfather came over from Sicily to this country. And he worked very hard and attained, owned his own business and attained a lot. But to answer your question about fear, I think really the fear is that most Americans fear that they have achieved a lot of things off the back of others. And that their true fear is that they'll lose these things, or that, Reverend Wright said, that the chickens are coming home to roost. And I believe that that's a true fear with a lot of Americans that I've talked to and been around. And that's my perspective, and I thank you.
Thanks very much for the call and for sharing that. I think also famously that the chickens coming home to roost was a quote that got Malcolm X into a lot of trouble. He made it in reference to John F. Kennedy's assassination more than 50 years ago. But I guess we have to talk about this, too, because it does tie into that notion somehow of there is a racial component to this, obviously, and an ethnic component to these fears. That whole question, Ali, of white privilege or white entitlement. Western European entitlement, I guess, would be more appropriate. I know that's a minefield to walk into, but I'm going to ask you to at least take a few steps into it.
So you're going to throw that one to me, huh?
First, yeah. Well, you're the one who's got the national perspective here.
Yeah. Well, I would actually take this back to all of us wanting our families to do better, our children to do better than us. And, I'm here in San Francisco today for some meetings. And I was talking to somebody who, and this came up in the conversation. And he says to me, you know what? I'm a person of color, but whatever privilege I have, I want to make sure that my kids have as well. So it's a perfectly natural and human reaction to hold on to what you have. But I guess the challenge here is, how do you take that fear, that holding on to something, and get beyond the idea of it being a zero-sum game? And I just have to go back to the importance of institutions that we relate to. Kind of another example from the Midwest is the Wesleyan Church. Mm-hmm. I think what Joanne Lyons did while she's president of the church, and what current leadership are doing to really help pastors at the local level open their institutions so that churches across the Midwest, across Indiana, from the Wesleyan community, are seen as very diverse institutions where, somebody has been, in that community for generations. They see an immigrant family from Guatemala as a net plus, not just to the church, but to the community writ large. And I just think that we have to continue to kind of think through what are the vehicles and the strategies and the leaders at the local level that kind of expand this idea of privilege. So privilege is not seen just something for us as individuals, but for entirety of communities.
Because that question, we've got a lot of email questions I'd like to get to, but because that question is so essential, Angela, Terry, if either one of you wants to weigh in. Okay. We've gotten an email from a listener named
Jane. This is the downside, I guess, of being on Skype, that you can't just shake your head.
Yeah. we've gotten an email from a listener named Gene, and if you want to join the conversation by email, you can send the email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Gene writes, when did limits on immigration begin, many people say my parents slash grandparents, or we could even go back, great-grandparents, came, and she puts in quotes, the right way. But as I understand, the limits on immigration began at about World War II time. Is that correct, Angela? And I think it's more complicated than that. I mean, obviously, in the late 19th centuries, we had a lot of fear of of immigration from Asia in particular. In the early part of the 20th century, we were freaked out about Eastern and Southern Europeans. So this is a recurrent sort of of panic in our history.
And the law seems to reflect that as well. During the time, whatever we were dealing with as a country or as a world in the world events on the stage, I think it's always a reactionary. The law kind of reacts to what's going on politically, but also, I guess, within country-specific and relationships with other countries. But yes, I think that question's very complicated. She's right. Our laws have changed over time. They have not always been this way. In fact, again, once again, another good example of this is before 9/11, we had some more, I guess I would call them reasonable and workable solutions within the immigration laws that after 9/11 just went away. And everything changed. So it really those events and those stories actually impact our policies. And then it takes, as Ali is saying, it takes a long time to shift that tone in the conversation and the culture of immigration. Once something so big happens, it's like everybody, you know, becomes afraid once again.
Ali, I'm gonna. From a national perspective, does the fear take different forms in different parts of the country? I mean, is it place specific?
I think the fear is pretty consistent across the country, and it's a combination of a fear based on national security, a fear based on jobs and the economy, and a fear based on culture and cultural change. But conversely, I also think that the optimism and the energy to kind of address these challenges and these fears in an honest way is also pretty similar across the country. And I'm talking about, you know, the Southeast, the Midwest, the Mountain West. And, you know, I was in Idaho a few weeks ago and was sitting down with, members of the dairy industry who, was a room of about 75 people, the majority of whom voted for President Trump, and they were just as worried about the direction of the nation's immigration enforcement policy as anybody else. But it wasn't for them an economic fear. It was, you know, they weren't worried just that, you know, their Hispanic workforce would be detained and deported. Rather, they were worried that their Hispanic workforce would be profiled and marginalized because they saw their workforce as an extension of their families and their community, because they've known these people for 10 plus years. So that optimism, I think, and that desire to engage in this question in a constructive way from even a conservative perspective, where, you know, a lot of these fears are in bubble, I think is based on those relationships and is based on a common set of values of, you know, belief in family, a belief in hard work. So, you know, to answer your question, yes, the fears are similar across the country, but I also think that the ways that people are addressing those fears are similar. And, you know, I just can't help but to be optimistic that there are a lot of folks at the local level who, you know, voted for President Trump, but are looking for constructive ways to engage.
We've gotten an email from a listener named Jean. Again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Jean writes, I'm curious as to why there are not any representatives of the opposing viewpoint about the amount of immigration on your panel. There are many of us out there who would like to see a temporary pause in the current high levels of immigration. This was suggested by a presidential commission back in the 1990s. It's really about overpopulation in the numbers, not just irrational fears. After all, the last time I checked, they are not making more land. Well, I'll deal with I'll throw the issue-based stuff. We've done many shows on immigration. And, for example, State Senator Mike Delf has had a standing invitation to come in here and talk. He's proposed bans on immigration here when former governor, now current Vice President Mike Pence, tried to ban Syrian refugees from coming to Indiana. He also had a standing invitation to come in here and talk about it. We've extended many invitations to folks like that. So I guess, sir, I would toss back to you. Please call the folks who represent your point of view and encourage them to come in here and take part in the discussion. You know, take a few steps out into the water. We will be respectful. That's what we do here. So, and we want to have as many viewpoints as possible heard. As to the policy thing, is the idea that immigration is creating overpopulation problems in the United States something we should be concerned about? Ali, I'll throw that one to you first.
Sure. Well, I think a couple of things here. One is when you look at the data shows that the immigrant community, as they come to the U.S., they use less in resources, whether it's environmental resources or public resources, than folks who have been here for generations. So I think the environmental footprint of the immigrants to the U.S. is smaller than those who have been born here. But I think more than that, I think we as a country should be valuing people. We should be valuing the work that all people are doing. And that, I don't think we should be in the business of population control. I think that every life is valuable. And if we start to move down this path where we believe that, the resources that we have, the innovation that we have as a nation and as leaders is limited, then I think we as a country are not just on a slippery slope. We're sliding down pretty quickly a slippery slope if we stop valuing people and really just, start to question the value of families and of life.
This seems to be another variation of the question that someone's going to come in here and take away something that is mine or that would be mine, the land. Has the growth, we're for all practical purposes, the unemployment rate has dropped enough now that we're approaching at least what the economists would call full employment, because there's always, somewhere, I know they disagree, somewhere between 3% and 5% of the workforce that's always in transition. So if you get down below that 5% number, they generally say you're pretty close to full employment. Admittedly, there are still tremendous disparities, and there are a lot of people who are working very hard. But is there evidence that these folks really are taking jobs that I find it difficult even to say native-born Americans? I don't think any one of us is a Native American on this panel. But, immigrants of more distant vintage who would be denied opportunities by the folks who are coming in now. Terry.
In our work at the Immigrant Welcome Center, we are very regularly contacted by potential employers who are seeking workers to increase their workforce. We have many, many jobs available in central Indiana. And there, in my experience, is just no, there's plenty of jobs for everyone. And I can't see any data that says that immigrants are pulling jobs away from Americans. I just don't see it.
Angela, you.
Well, I was going to question. I'm not sure when he says high levels of immigration, what the numbers that he's actually referring to in comparison and comparatively. I'm not sure that we would agree that they're high or low. I think I think that it's not necessarily about the numbers. It's more about the eligibility criteria for how we have categories of eligibility for folks that need the proper visa and to get them in the status that they need to be in to contribute fully to the economy and not to be exploited, as a question mm-hmm. previously, so that they're not exploited by some of those jobs, the lower education jobs and low skilled jobs. But I think there's another important point here is that it's not just the immigrants that are coming to our country, but the immigrants that are already here. I think that we have, 11 to 12 million? We don't even know if that's an accurate number, but undocumented immigrants in the United States. And we can well assume that most of them are working, whether they're working lawfully or not. And I'm not condoning that you work unlawfully. I'm just stating a reality here. I would never tell someone to work without authorization. That's against the law. But the reality is there are people here who are undocumented who are working. And my fear or my fear and combined with, maybe even a hope is that if those are brought to light and if someone tries to deport all of those immigrants that are here working lawfully, it will greater negatively impact our economy.
We've got an email question from a regular listener named Ben. And in the interest, because we've only got a couple of minutes before the show ends here, I'm going to consolidate. Ben says basically, you know, the opponents of immigration tend to be conservative and all of that. Mm-hmm. How they square their posture with their personal Hoosier hospitality values. Terry, I'm going to let you take a crack at that one.
I believe that many conservatives also see the value of a diverse workforce. Many are business owners, are in management, and many come to us and say, I can't run a successful business without immigrants and refugees. And so they see immigrants and refugees as an economic benefit for their business, for our communities. And so they're in somewhat of a conundrum there because socially they think it's not right for me to support immigration, but they realize that the business side of and the economic development side of it requires immigrants to be here.
I'm afraid at this time that will have to be the last word. I'd like to thank my guests, Terry Downs and Angela Adams and Ali Nourani, for what's been a provocative conversation. I want to reiterate something that I said a little earlier in response to a listener's question. We want these to be open conversations with as many different points of view represented as possible. This is not going to be the last time we're going to talk about immigration. So I would encourage anyone who has views on this to get in touch with us and take part in the discussion. That's the only way we are going to resolve things. We will be back on Thursday when we're going to have another difficult conversation about race. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.